Lonnie. Jarek is here today, giving a weekend seminar. As you all know him, he is one of the best five elemental teachers out there, and he's not just about teaching about acupuncture points and the logistical stuff that we all learned in TCM school, but he talks about something much vaster and bigger than ourselves. So, and then I forgot about the housekeeping first. Is down the stairs to the right, halfway down the hallway, is a break room with some apples and bananas. Please take some bananas to go because they didn't really ripen up. Everything's organic. There's tea. There's coffee. The side door out there will be locked. So if you go out the side door, come in the front door. That will be open. And then the bathrooms are past the break room down that hallway. Okay. And then without further ado, let me introduce Lonnie Jarek.
Thank you, everybody. So thanks very much for coming today. And I want to thank both Shang and Mary for sponsoring this and doing all the work to get me out here. Mary has generously donated this room.
Without windows.
Without windows.
Sorry.
Well, windows are nice. Sunlight's good. But we'll make do. There's at least oxygen, which is a good thing.
Let's draw a window right here.
And yeah, I told her she should project one on the screen and then just put an ozonator. We'd be good. And Shang is a very dear and old friend from Western Massachusetts who I knew nearly 20 years ago back there, who as a patient, and then she went on to acupuncture school, and great to be out here. And it's a beautiful part of the world, as you know. It's an honor and privilege to have you come spend the time with me for the next 2 days when you could be out in the most beautiful place on earth, just going around. So I will endeavor to make it worth your while. When I teach, just I have some notes, but I just glance at them now and then, and I'm really just teaching stream of consciousness, so ask questions. If anything I say is counter to something you believe to be true, or you want to discuss it or bring up another point of view, just raise your hand and we can turn it into a dialogue, and that's fine. Just a little bit about me, I guess. I decided when I was 17 that more or less I wanted to do Chinese medicine, but it wasn't really practical from a point of view for a Jewish guy from Long Island to do Chinese medicine in 1974. So I went through school in psychology and neurobiology, went through grad school in neuroscience, and left grad school with a master's degree, gave up the PhD, because at that time there were a couple acupuncture schools in the country, and I decided I'd be much happier doing that. I primarily studied in a school that was founded by an English gentleman named J.R. Worsley. I went to that school for 2 years. When I got out, I took a 2-year herb course with Ted Kapchuk. And while I was in school, I met a physician named Leon Hammer, who's a psychiatrist who was practicing Chinese medicine. And he lived near me, so when I graduated and set up my office, I contacted him, and I spent 10 years running all his seminars out of my office space. And would follow him around in clinic and had many long conversations with him. He's 92 now and living down in Florida. And last time we had lunch, he told me that he thinks it's fair to say he has accomplished 50% of his life's work. And he is going strong and riding every day as far as I know. And so the two main traditions that I've studied, well, three, are the Worsley five-element model, the deep, very profound eight principle physiology through the pulse system I've learned. So when I see a new patient, I spend 2 hours doing an intake, and I take everybody's pulse for 20 to 40 minutes, depending on how much there is to read there. The pulse system has 85 qualities, 9 different depths, 50 places to put your finger. And it's very deep contemplation, very deep contemplative practice. And then, of course, there's the herbs that I learned from Ted. It was only a 150-hour course, which at the time was the longest, most extensive course given in the country. So now the average graduate who gets out of school has like four times the amount of education in herbs. So I practice herbs very idiosyncratically, but I can say whatever I'm doing seems to work for my patients. And I think that's important. So we're going to be talking about trauma, how to treat trauma. Last time I gave this lecture, I think, was in Denver in April. There were 150 people, and 148 gave it like 10 out of 10, and then two people hated it. And one of the people said he was a sports physiologist who works with athletes, and nothing I said had any relevance to the work he was doing. Which is just weird, because you'd think he'd have read the two-paragraph description of the course before signing up. But just for the sake of transparency, I am not going to sort out for anyone where liver 14 really is. And we're not going to cover how to treat shin splints with gallbladder 34. But we are going to talk about a lot of other stuff. So we have a two-day class, and the first day is philosophical perspective. It's philosophical context. It's creating a base for understanding what I will present tomorrow, and tomorrow is going to be practically treatments that you can go in and start doing Monday morning, if you want, on people. So tomorrow's going to be the technical and the knowledge base, but technique and knowledge always serve a person's value system, their own level of integrity, and their own philosophical depth. Technique and knowledge are just vehicles for the transmission of consciousness. That's all they are. So today we have to focus on consciousness as the foundation. And when I teach, I'm always lecturing from three perspectives. Three main perspectives. I'm sure there must be other perspectives. I mean, certainly there's the Long Island Jewish perspective, but we don't have to spend a lot of time on that. But everyone is always speaking from a perspective. Everyone is always speaking from a perspective, and it's good to have one's perspectives to be as self-consciously held as possible. Because if to the degree they're not self-consciously held, they're just genetically programmed and culturally reinforced, which means they're unconscious. And the hour is getting late for us to be holding unconscious perspectives. So the three main perspectives I'm teaching from are integral, spiritual, and evolutionary. And I'd like to talk for just a moment to create context. The thing is, in Chinese medicine, it's, as you probably know, it's a contextual medicine. Contextual means you can't teach anything about Chinese medicine and have it be meaningful without already having taught everything else about Chinese medicine. So you start to learn this when you go to acupuncture school and nothing is making any sense until about 12 years later. Because then you finally, after 10 or 12 years, you have the context to understand the first lecture you ever had. And I can just say it's my experience after being in the field for 37 years, with 30 years of full-time practice, that every day I sit there and go, oh, I think I'm getting this. I always know how much attention a person has been paying to their clinical practice by how much humility they have. So I think what we're endeavoring to practice a non-symptomatic, holistic, and preventive medicine is requires a lot of humility as a foundation, right? And if you read acupuncture on Facebook daily, and we're blessed to have Jasmine Patel, the moderator of that site here, you can see that there's not a lot of humility to go around. The same people who are arguing over where spleen 6 really is and making death threats to each other going ad hominem are the same people who think that the Israelis and the Arabs could just make peace if only they cared enough. Because they're not fighting anything over nearly as significant as what she is. So the three, let's just take a minute and talk about the three perspectives. So the first perspective is integral. We could meet every day for 3 months, 7 days a week, and I could give you an 8-hour lecture on integral. But it all boils down to a couple of notions. The term integral was coined by an Indian gentleman from India named Sri Aurobindo, and he's the founder of integral yoga. And what he meant by integral yoga was a yoga that leaves no part of the self behind. Very simple. A yoga means a practice that leaves no part of the self behind. So when I say that I'm teaching from an integral perspective, what I'm aspiring to do is to create and practice a medicine that leaves no part of the self behind. And the implication is that one will not have access to the totality of any other human being beyond the degree to which they have access to their own self. So integral means non-dual. It means the recognition of a non-dual context, which practically means there is no recognized separation between the practitioner and patient. The practitioner and patient are one, so to know my patient, I know myself. Now, it's certainly true that I don't have to have given birth to treat infertility effectively. That's obvious. I don't have to have had MS or sciatica or any one of the myriad symptoms to treat it effectively. So on a physical level, it's a non-issue. But on psychological, emotional, soul, and spirit levels, a practitioner is incapable of leading a patient to a degree of wholeness that is more whole than that degree of wholeness the practitioner, him or herself, has been willing to pay the price to embrace. Yes.
I just have a comment.
Sure.
I like to sum that up in like a way that I kind of relate to it. That's how I am. So I'll do that. It's you can only take your patients as far as you're willing to go.
Yeah. Yes, except for, because everything, we don't want to make any particular we want to have the courage to look through the eyes of a perspective absolutely to reveal its strengths and weaknesses, but we also have to have humility. So we don't want to reduce that to an absolute principle because there is such a thing as grace. There's a mysterious X factor. But the more humility we can have and the more we work on ourselves, the more access we'll have in terms of being able to make room for the emergence of that. So there is something at work here beyond just our own selves. But as a general principle, the way you summed it up is, I would agree with that. So integral means, simply again, we endeavor to practice a medicine that leaves no part of the self behind. And in order to do that, I need to have access to all the different dimensions of my own self, a non-abstract living relationship to the totality of myself as a human being. And it is my deep and broad experience as a 58-year-old who's been paying attention for close to 5 decades, that most people have a very abstract relationship to what they're doing. Most people in Chinese medicine have a very abstract relationship to the medicine. And that even scholars, even some of the best scholars, have a very abstract relationship to the self and to what they're actually talking about. They have information, they have knowledge, they can cite this fact and that fact, but when you ask them to talk about it in their own experience, they say, I don't understand what you're talking about, or they say it's private. which those two things mean the same thing. So if you ask somebody to discuss their relationship to spirit practically, and they say it's private, they couldn't know what they were talking about, since that would be the least private thing.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, so that covers integral. The next perspective is evolutionary. Evolutionary to me means, very simply, again, we could have a month-long course on this. It just, we can sum it up to a very basic principle. It means the recognition of a context of development without end. The principle that typifies all pre-modern teachings, so the modern era started in 1650 with Descartes, and right, and then really started to flourish around Darwin and the discovery of evolution. All the pre-modern teachings are typified by a mythic end state, whether it be heaven or enlightenment, samsara is infinite, and the overcoming of samsara would be this idealized mythic end state of enlightenment, where enlightenment means the end of development. Enlightenment means that one ceases to become. It's the end of development. In an evolutionary context, that's just revealed to be a myth. An evolutionary context combined with an integral context, from an integral perspective, we recognize that a human being is a collection of a great number of capacities, and those capacities are different lines of development. So there's sexual, emotional, psychological, spiritual, soul level, artistic, creative, intellectual, cognitive. There are all these different lines of development. They're all at different states and stages of development. They're all expressed through different states, and they're all in different stages of development. And from an integral and evolutionary standpoint, we're talking about embracing a medicine that looks at a human being as an infinite process with no beginning and no end, and looks for the development of all the lines and all the capacities without end, with no known end state.
Yes.
Thanks, Mary. With no known end state. So that's what evolutionary means. So the pre-modern traditions posited heaven, enlightenment, emptiness, the embrace of emptiness, but there was an end state at which point, when the human being fully realized it, they became the mythic embodiment of the absolute in physical form. And then a lot of those traditions focused on disembodying the light from the body, because light has no shadow. You need a body to have shadow. So they all looked at disembodying the light from the body. So you have the rainbow body, or the body of light. And all of that is a patriarchal, solar formulation that denies the unconscious and the mother and the unknown and emptiness. And it's repressive. And when we talk about an integral medicine, we're talking about a medicine that denies no part of the self, including the body and including the unconscious, and looks for a deep integration and transcendence of the distinction between masculine and feminine as dualistic absolute archetypes, right? Mm-hmm. Which doesn't mean everyone turns into Boy George, or I don't really think we know what it looks like. And no offense meant to Boy George, but who's an incredibly talented whatever he is.
I just had a comment. Everybody has a male and a female side to them.
Well, that's true. So men have an anima and women have an animus. And what we're talking about at the stage of evolution where we're at is the potential for an integration of those two. I'm just pointing out, I don't think it looks like androgyny.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also pointing out, I don't know exactly what it looks like, because I think humanity is barely there.
Mm-hmm. I'd agree with that.
Mm-hmm. If it looks like Boy George, I'm going to have to do some serious shopping. Yeah. Well, this is more from more inspired by Jimi Hendrix, I'd like to think, who is perhaps closer to Boy George than Bruce Springsteen. Okay. So we covered integral, we covered evolutionary, and then we'll discuss spiritual. So when we discuss spirit in Chinese medicine, we're discussing Shen, and we can talk about Shen. The character for Shen is I got one here. But I was cynical. I said,
the first one won't work.
Everywhere I go, these things never work.
So, you just created it.
So Shen is Shen, the number one, mm-hmm. heaven. The number two, earth. Mm-hmm. The number three, heaven, human, earth, Jing, Qi, Shen, moon, star, sun. So the character Shen is the cosmogony of the universe. The one, the two, the three. And then on the left, on the right here, rather, we have two hands lowering a rope, which is also, if we just go like that, the character for lightning or electricity. So it gives the sense of the radiance of the moon, stars, and sun from heaven. The portents of what will be, illuminating what actually is in real time. And that rope is the means by which the light of heaven extends itself to us through lightning, but through commands, through direct commands, thou shalt, in a mythic context. And it's also a rope by which we can pull ourselves up and aspire and strive toward what is higher. So when we talk about Shen, we can make the distinction of Shen large S and Shen small S. And Shen small S is the human mind, personality, force of animation in the individual. And Shen large S is the one undifferentiated ocean of consciousness and love that's experienced as love and consciousness in the entire universe that recognizes no separation. It recognizes no separation. And all of matter in the universe appears on an infinite background of this field of consciousness. And what we describe as a spiritual experience would be the usually momentary breaking down of the distinction between Shen large S and Shen small S. And when that apparent barrier breaks down or dissolves even for a moment, people in Eastern cultures made statements like, I am that. And in Western cultures said things like, the Father and I are one, which are both same statements as the recognition of no separation and the recognition of self in an infinite context. So spirit, we can recognize, has two directions, and those two directions are all the way down and all the way up. So all the way down is transcendence, and all the way up is immanence. So spirit is two directions, transcendence and immanence. Transcendence means return to the source. And immanence is the trajectory of the creative impulse, the evolutionary impulse, spirit, the life force toward the true, the good, the beautiful in creation. So it's a relentless striving toward integration and wholeness. And that's the nature of the life force. So if we want to look at the practice of the medicine through spiritual eyes, as the Shenong Bonsao did, right? So the title of my book, Nourishing Destiny, is actually taken from the first line of the Shennong Bonsao, which is the first herbal text in China, which apparently was written about 300 to 200 BC, although the only existing version we have is about 200 AD, but it's listed in libraries as having existed 400 or 500 years earlier, though we don't have a copy. But the first words are, the highest practice of medicine corresponds to heaven and nourishes the fulfillment of destiny. So that's where I got the title for my book. So if we're going to look at medicine through spiritual eyes, then we realize the foundation of medicine is consciousness, the integral evolution of consciousness, the liberation of consciousness. And when we liberate spirit, when we liberate consciousness in medicine, in the practice of medicine, we can do two things. We can eliminate what's false and strengthen the presence of what's true. Those are the two avenues available to us. Eliminating what's false means moving stagnation, whatever that stagnation is, and strengthening what's true is working with Jing Qi, Shen, Yuan Qi, Zheng Qi, Jun Qi, whatever, however you want to think about it in terms of the language of Chinese medicine, to strengthen what's real. And when we eliminate what's false and get it out of the way and strengthen the presence of what's real, the direction is an instantaneous transcendence back to the source, a discovery of oneself as unborn, and simultaneously a liberation of light to travel higher, to vertically ascend, to recontextualize all technique and all knowledge in a 360-degree sphere, so everything is understood from a higher perspective. And when that light moves higher, there is a movement in every dimension of the individual to express the true, the good, the beautiful, through word and through action, to be a higher expression of it. Evolutionarily, evolution means there's no end to the depth that can be embraced, and there's no limit to the height that can be embraced, practically speaking, as far as we can tell. So those are the three contexts. So it's within that context, all my writing, all my teaching, all my posts on Facebook, even the one about chemtrails the other day. Did people see that one? I put up a picture of Mount Shasta with the chemtrails over it, right? And I just said, I don't believe in chemtrails and I don't want to discuss it. But I put, as a joke, I put up a picture and I said, and there were these long lines of whatever they are, and I said, the chemtrails are beautiful today. I'm naming my next album, Bomb Me with Barium. So I lost like 20 friends. 10 of whom unfriended me because they thought I believed in chemtrails, and the other 10 unfriended me because they thought I was making fun of chemtrails. Put them in a room and let them fight it out. I will then take the survivor out to dinner and explain that it was just a joke. But the last post I put up last week, 2 weeks ago, that generated so much controversy was that you can't throw a rock without hitting a sensitive person. I think that's funny and ironic. Anyway, so moving on. So everything I teach is in this context. Everything I teach and everything I say. So we're going to be talking about trauma, and we'll talk a bit about physical trauma, but what I'm interested in is the liberation of consciousness. I'll just be perfectly frank that I didn't go into Chinese medicine because I gave a damn about getting people's carpal tunnel syndrome better with needles. I mean, that is not why I went in. We're in the middle of the largest species extinction in 250,000 years. We're on the verge of World War III. The oceans are dying. Fukushima is pouring radiation, and there's no known way to stop it, into the Pacific Ocean. And there aren't enough tinfoil hats, apparently. The government has run out of aluminum because they've been spraying it. Who would think to wear a tinfoil hat to protect yourself from aluminum? It makes absolutely no sense. So there are some serious things going on. So in that context, what is the context of treating Mrs. Jones' back pain at a time in history when her species is threatened with extinction? So I didn't say there's no point to it. I'm just asking what the context is. And it seems to me that up until the Industrial Revolution, with the emergence of a middle class that had disposable income and leisure time to attend events like this just because they wanted to. So prior to the emergence of a middle class and centralized heating and sewer systems, the main evolutionary forces were forces that acted upon us and we were victims of them. But since we've had leisure time, there's a demographic and leisure money, right? Discretionary money. There's a demographic of people that has emerged that's actually capable of determining their own course of evolution. And it seems to me that since the Industrial Revolution, the main threats to human survival are decisions that we're making, unconscious decisions that we're making. So to me, the great imperative of medicine is the integral evolution of spirit and the liberation of spirit through the human being. For this, and it better happen quickly. It better happen quickly. So we're at a stage in development which is very interesting because, one, nobody can presume any degree of privacy anymore. And no one who's paying attention can presume having any more time left. Now, this is interesting to me because it brings up the distinction between being serious and deadly serious. So everyone in the room is serious. Only serious people spend $300-$400 and take 2 days of their lives to come to a seminar and travel in under extraordinarily difficult conditions. Only serious people do that. But a person can be serious for many lifetimes and never go all the way, which is why the number of seekers far outnumber the number of finders, and why the number of people interested in healing far outnumber the number who are healed. Right? So the distinction is that when a person's deadly serious, they renounce the presumption of having any time left. And when a person renounces the presumption of time, things start to become crystal clear. And some things that had seemed very important up till the moment of becoming deadly serious are instantaneously revealed to have been meaningless and trivial. And some things which were not on the radar screen instantly come into focus as having to happen right now, regardless of what cost has to be paid. So what I have discovered in my practice is that most people have relegated whatever amount of time they have left in their life to overcoming whatever part of life they've already lived. And that is not living. That is not living. That is spending one's entire incarnation getting ready to be ready. And when a person is getting ready to be ready, they're in the locker room doing push-ups, even though the coin has been tossed and the ball is in the air and both teams are on the field. And you say, "Don't you understand? The game is on." And the person says, "That's very judgmental. Can't you see how hard I'm working? I'm sitting here doing infinite amount of push-ups, and you're just not compassionate. I'm not ready to be out on the field because I'm a wounded warrior. And you can't ask for me what you can ask of other people because they're doing better than me. Because what affected me as deeply as it did because I'm very sensitive. Do you understand? Which is a complete objectification of everybody else's being less sensitive. And the I'm very sensitive and I'm deeply wounded by what happens to me, it means I need more time. And the difference between being serious and deadly serious is the deadly serious person has given up the notion of having any more time left or needing any more time. And you can just practically see this when a man or woman comes into your clinic and their partner has just told them that they want out of the relationship. All of a sudden, they're like, oh, it's such an opportunity and we can do counseling and we can do this and I'm seeing that and everything's crystal clear focus because there's no more time left. And when a man or a woman comes in and there's a little black spot on their skin and it's melanoma and it's going to take a week to see their doctor and another week to get a biopsy and another week to get the results back, that 3 weeks will be the most intensive inquiry they do in your clinical and practice, even if you've been seeing them for 30 years. All of a sudden they're interested and they're stopped complaining about nonsense and they're asking the big questions. And when the tests come back with, oh, it wasn't a melanoma, it's just a thing and we'll just take it off and you're fine. And you begin, well, what about what we talked about in last session? They're like, it's like, I call it star witness goes mum. or Peter denies Jesus is another good. Okay. Are you sure that was me? Oh, I was just saying that stuff, you know. We can go back to talking about, you know, the last Game of Thrones episode.
I just wanted you to repeat the first sentence you said, the way you worded it, about people will spend the first half of the second half of life.
Yeah, that most people have relegated the amount of life they have left to overcoming the part they've already lived. People are in an endless process of healing. Now look, people experience horrific things. Far more, everybody has suffered. Everybody has suffered. By the time any human being has reached our age, they've suffered. And everybody's suffering is as real to them as anybody else's suffering. And the simple thought experiment you can do is if you took a cigarette and put it out in your hand, and then you put all your attention into that burn, you'd be suffering as much as a person who was scalded on 90% of their body. Because your pain would still be consuming 100% of your attention. So everybody's suffering is as real to them as everybody else's suffering, and we have to understand that. And I've certainly suffered and felt tremendous pain in my life, and for the sake of humility, have to acknowledge that it ain't nothing. The amount of pain I've felt, while it has at times been all-consuming and heartbreaking, is just incidental compared to the average life that actually most people on this planet live. Right? Mm-hmm. So we need to have some humility in relationship to that. And then I guess it's just a question of how much we care and what we care about. And if we care to the degree we care about something bigger than our own selves, there's infinite will and infinite resources to have us overcome that suffering. Now, most people think, I have to restore my heart and I have to learn to trust again. And for most people, what that means is really just reconstructing the ego. And condensing as a condensation of pride around the heart. And what I've learned, at least in my own life experience, that the better part of maturity and enlightenment is just embracing living with an open heart, renouncing any notion of needing to heal, and living with the heart as it is, living with a broken heart, having the humility and the care to live with a broken heart without needing to erect any barrier around it. Because that barrier is always one of pride, and pride is what creates separation. So people have suffered terribly, and it's very important to be able to make contact with any human being, with our patients, and it's reasonable to look somebody in the eye and say, I'm so sorry that happened to you. and mean it from the depth of one's soul. I'm so sorry that happened. This is a suffering beyond anything I've known. If I could take some of this for you, I would gladly do it. And mean it. Come to a place of compassion in one's own life. We need to acknowledge at the outset that every human being's life experience in this moment makes them the perfect vessel for a degree of transcendence and imminent expression of spirit to engender the humility, the compassion, and the wisdom to be able to serve their incarnation. And nobody has any life experience that's in the way of being a perfect vessel for the transmission of spirit into the world, right here and right now. Mm-hmm. That there's no amount of life experience that's necessarily in the way. And to the degree things are in the way, it's either because of the patient's own ignorance, the individual's own ignorance, or a conscious or unconscious choice being made to identify with being a victim. Now that's true, and we always have to struggle for the perfect balance between truth and compassion. So truth without compassion can be brutal and cause an ego backlash, rejection, closing down, a level of resistance that is not beneficial to treatment. And compassion without truth is just collusion and hand-holding, codependent in every 12-step sense of the word. So we're always striving, I'm always striving in my life, humbly acknowledging there will be no end to this for eternity, toward that balance of truth and compassion in action and communication. But once we've acknowledged the level of a person's suffering, made eye contact, held their hand, said, I'm sorry, and meant it, there's no place else to go but forward. Once we've done that, there's just no place else to go but straight ahead. To the degree an individual is unconscious, who they are in the most significant contribution to who they are in any moment reflects their past. To the degree an individual is unconscious, unenlightened, asleep, and ignorant, who the most significant input into who they are in any moment is their past. They're a victim of past circumstance. To the degree any individual is awake, enlightened, evolving, integrally, evolutionarily enlightened and evolving, the most significant input into who they are in any moment is the future they're striving to create. And it doesn't take time to create the future. Human beings are the only vehicle I'm aware of that can creatively imagine a better future and live like it's already here without taking time, without presuming time. So if we look at Rosa Parks, there's a woman who envisioned a better future and acted in the moment like it was already here, right? So she started the Montgomery bus boycott. She didn't say, I'm going to go to college and law school, get a law degree, run for Senate, and change these laws. She just sat down on the bus. So to the degree a person is unconscious, their mind and their body is a vehicle for the past to emerge into the present. And to the degree to which a human being is awake, their mind and their body are vehicles for the future to emerge in the present. Now, we want to look through these distinctions absolutely, but recognize that nobody's ever entirely free of the past, and nobody's ever entirely free to create the future. We're all products of culture. But when we talk about freedom, we can distinguish two forms of freedom. So when we talk about liberating spirit, we're talking about creating a free individual. And there are two distinctions we can make about how freedom can manifest in the human being. The person who's wounded and traumatized and identified as a victim is not free. Their past, their trauma, is limiting their potential to express the future through themselves in the moment. There are two types of freedom. The Eastern version of freedom is freedom from, and the Western version of freedom is freedom to. Freedom from and freedom to. So all we have to do is compare the mythic picture of Buddha and Jesus. So Buddha is free from sitting under the Bodhi tree. I'm going to sit here until I get enlightened. And he becomes free from. And Jesus is free too. So if you look at the picture of Jesus with a crown of thorns carrying the crucifix up the hill, he was free too. Somebody says, I want to follow you, I recognize you. But first I have to bury my father according to Hebrew law. He says, let the dead bury the dead, everybody else let's go. Buddha has nowhere to go and nothing to do. Jesus has somewhere to go and everything to do. And what we're looking for is an awakening and an embrace of a freedom that transcends, that incorporates, includes the strengths of both of these positions and transcends their relative limitations. And we're capable of holding both these enlightenments and actually moving to a third position beyond either. Because you just have to go to Asia and see there's no infrastructure. When you're free from, you don't create roads. You ever go to Rishikesh? What was that trip like? It's like hell. It's like a journey through the Bardo realms. And in the West, our hell is that our technology has gone so far beyond our ethical development. You get off the plane in India and you step into a field of 10,000 years of funeral pyres, hashish, and incense. And into this meditative current, you just get off the plane and you're like, whoa. Right? But there's nothing happening, baby. I mean, there is in some of the cities now, and they're starting to get psychoanalysts. Well, psychoanalysis is taking the place of meditation and spirituality in some of the cities now. That's what happens when you become free of the oppressive regime. You start driving yourself mad. Because you've... No, well, you've... I'm glad you're liking the material. I'm going to hire you to come to all of my classes. So the jokes may not be funny by the third or fourth. But I always deliver them as sincerely, so even though... It's they're like always the same yet ever new. Okay, so there are these two kinds of freedom. What we're endeavoring to do when we are seeking to heal people from trauma is to make them free of it. And the popular conception of what it would mean to be free of it, the New Age sort of psychological conception is, I won't feel angry anymore, I won't feel rage anymore, I'll learn to trust. And I won't have to feel all these uncomfortable emotions and sensations, and all these bad memories will stop plaguing me. And that has nothing to do with healing. Healing has everything to do with one's relationship to these things. It has nothing to do with the whole notion of healing as being left alone by the contents of one's experience stored in the mind is a victimized formulation that can't go anywhere. Being free means the recognition that in the face of that, I'm free. And it doesn't take time. It's right here, right now. In the face of my life experience, in the face of everything that happened, not only am I free of it, but I've just awoken to something and discovered myself in such a way that I wouldn't trade any of that experience, because it's actually, I've just recognized that given it, I'm the perfect vehicle for expressing something unique, true, good, and beautiful in the world. And that's what I was put here to do. And whatever happened to me in the past was never in the way, could never be the way, and in the way. Nothing's in the way where I'm now, and in fact, nothing could ever happen that's in the way of the expression of what I've just discovered, who I actually am. Nothing could ever be in the way. From an integral point of view, the practitioner has to have woken up to this, experienced it, and actually found out what it takes to live it. And through waking up to what I'm talking about and discovering what price has to be paid for actually living with fidelity to it, it's that journey that creates in us the humility and the wisdom and the compassion so that who we are before we've said a word, prescribed an herb, or put a needle in, it's actually who we literally are in the moment that's healing. And all the knowledge we have and all the technique we have is merely a vehicle for the transmission of that. And nothing more. And that's the foundation of everything. Our own development's the foundation of everything. If the practitioner is in an endless stage of healing, look, we've had 130 years of healing. So the average, it would not be unusual in Ashland to get a practitioner who took LSD at Esalen with Stanislaw Grof and had sex sliding in the mud at Woodstock and had went to Kripalu and had chocolate mud packs put all over their face and did the sun dance and the rain dance, climbed Machu Picchu, did ayahuasca, did psychotherapy. They probably have a five-element acupuncturist, a TCM acupuncturist, a Kiko acupuncturist, a network chiropractor. The average person, their idea of the session they'd like would be to be in a room in a tub of water at about 108 degrees with a morphine cognac drip, Bujang Ichitong going into the left arm, and Shaya Wan going into the right arm. Six people of their chosen sexual identification with palm fronds going like this. Little Yanni on a $49 boombox. Maybe Katara. I don't know. And then a little bell in case they happen to, by some unfortunate circumstance, actually feel something. And then they could ring it and they could say, okay, I'm feeling a little tense, a little more Shaya Wan, please. Do you see? So conservative people go to doctors so they can get drugs and surgery, so they can feel better without having to change. And liberal people go to acupuncturists so they can feel better without having to change. And it is just simply, I believe, true that our job is to help people become the kind of people who don't have their problems. And their problems are the sum total expression of genetic conditioning, cultural conditioning. And all we can get people to do is take responsibility for what they can take responsibility for. There are some things programmed in the template. Look, your pancreas isn't making insulin. You need insulin. And there's no shame in that, and it's not because you strangled a cat in your last life. or because you didn't heal your relationship, because you didn't heal your relationship with your mother. It's not necessarily because of anything. I think it's superstitious to believe everything happens for a reason. Right? I think it's good to look for the reasons in everything that happens. But it's arrogant to think you could ever discern them, and we'll make some distinctions around this in a little while. But we want people reasonably to take with deadly seriousness, and to the degree a person is deadly serious, then there's going to be an actual authentic expression of joy. You see, that's the thing. That's the yin and the yang of it. So I mean a joy that is a joy replete with fullness and gratitude. And it's up to us as healers, I think, when we're taking money from people under the auspices of healing, I believe it is our it is our responsibility to look at our own healing as an obligation and a debt owed to all the human beings we exist in relationship to. So the irony to me, and one of the proofs of the intellectual abstraction that most people have in relationship to the medicine, is the medicine is about nothing but wholeness. And yet when people discuss the medicine, they create in a way that creates separation, they're denying wholeness. Right? So that to me is unfortunate and ironic. Right? Nobody's going to engender a greater wholeness. They're not going to help the officials of the inner kingdom talk to each other and embrace an inner harmony in a way that reflects any greater harmony than they have in the relationships in their own life. So anyway, I think, you know, this is a cause for humility. But it's also a cause for like a righteous sort of striving. And as practitioners, I mean, look, the NCCOM exam and the California exam, these are tests of your knowledge of medical anthropology. They have nothing to do, or little to nothing to do, with the skill set that's needed at this point in history to practice medicine. It is probably true that every age of humanity on the face of the earth always thought, this is it, we're fucked.
True.
Don't you think?
Yeah, definitely.
I didn't used to curse at all. And I decided I was a little uptight, so now I like to pepper my teaching with a little cursing. If you curse too much, then it's just vulgar, but if you insert them in the right places.
That was perfect.
Yeah, that was really, really good. So anyway, I think at every time in history, people have always presumed this is it. We're never going to get over this. But I don't think at any other time in I think probably it was true when there were 8 people on the planet. And in all interceding times, I think it was an illusion. Because there was no way that that typhoid that wiped out your entire village in China was going to spread to France. You see, but now I think, given that we live in one world, we actually have the technological capability mm-hmm. of doing it. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the best time to be alive. The most when Donald Trump talks about, like, and the Republicans generally, about going back to what? The only direction is forward. Mm-hmm. The only direction is forward. And the life impulse, the life impulse can be expressed as I can, I will, I must. I can, I will, I must. So if you think about it, it took God about 14 billion years to produce big lizards. Right? You understand? 14 billion years. So imagine this. You've just spent 14 billion years to produce big lizards, and in the blink of an eye, a meteor hits the freaking planet and they all die. And my presumption is that God did not say, start looking through his Rolodex for his therapist. Because he needed his, I know I came in yesterday, but I could really use another session today. Could you put that needle between my eyes? I really liked that one. It was really good. I doubt God got on the phone to Kripalu to book an emergency. You don't understand. I really need this. Things are really tense. God's attitude was just, okay, we're going with the mammals. And it took absolutely no time. So when the life impulse is liberated in an individual and a human being is awakened to it and recognize the life impulse as self, that human being expresses that no matter what the situation, no matter what happens, no matter what they have to encounter, they respond to it in a way that catalyzes the emergence of the true, the good, the beautiful. Our commitment as healers has to be to respond to whatever the pattern is in the moment in a way that brings it to a higher and deeper state of wholeness. And there's a price to pay for that, Because in the face of the impulse to catalyze the emergence toward the true, the good, the beautiful, when we, it's only at the moment we become deadly serious and take time out of the picture and engender to give our entire heart and soul to this, and only at the moment where we've committed our life to it, recognize this is why I'm here, that we'll come face to face with every part of ourself that has no interest in that whatsoever. Well, when we're just serious, we're never really going to meet our own resistance. When we're just meditating and taking ayahuasca and having tantric sex to someday get over our wounds and traumas and become enlightened, but it's never going to happen right now. It's always out there in an imagined future, but it's never right now. There's never any pressure. Things don't ever really get real. And when things aren't real, all the practice we do just deepens our attachment to fear and desire. If you're meditating to feel good, very sincerely, all your practice is just deepening fear and your connection to fear and desire. It's only the motive to be free right here, right now, that ever brings up the resistance. Madam, what's your name?
I'm Karen.
Karen.
I was going to ask why it's deadly serious. Is there some significance to that phrase and awareness of...
Yeah, it makes postmodern people really uptight. Man, he sounds so uptight. Why so uptight, man? We got all the time in the world. Living up here in the Applegate. Marijuana's free. No one can get to us down this road. And if those motherfuckers come, I've got an AK. Do you see? So there's something about the phrase like deadly serious, doesn't it create a little bit of tension?
Connection to the
well, homicidal could...
It says immediacy.
Yeah, it creates immediacy. Mm-hmm. No, but it's good to be deadly serious. Okay. Do you have a child?
No.
Do you have a cat?
Life-threatening.
You have a dog?
I love
you have a
dog.
Plant? You got a... you got a plant? You got to cultivate some relationships, so this metaphor would work a little better. Anyway, I would just say if you were asking because some part of yourself was a little uncomfortable, like the part of you that projected by what deadly serious meant was homicidal, was a projection that I was actually trying to kill part of you?
No, let's go with my explanation.
All right. Let's just give me the benefit of the doubt till 5 o'clock tomorrow.
Okay.
Right, so you just look at what part of yourself was uncomfortable and how it was uncomfortable with that phrasing. And just investigate that.
I was curious if it meant something of more of an awareness of our inevitable death, you know, living in a society where we tend
Well, in my experience, our inevitable death is an...
Death?
Inevitable death is an abstraction to the degree that it denies the realization that actually we're already dead. So there are many things one can see. There are many experience, higher state and deeper state experiences one can have. And one of them is the realization that we're actually already dead and we're actually exist in the... our soul actually exists in a state right here, right now of being asked ultimately to let go of that which we're most attached to. And that isn't just the future time projected abstractly in some Bardo realm that's going to happen and I'll deal with it then. There is no then. It's actually always just right now. And one isn't going to actually let go then to any degree more than one is actually doing it right now. And that's in a lot of cultures, right? The American Indians talked about walking side by side with death. And I think this is a deep realization in Zen and in Dzogchen, the Tibetan tradition. And one can see this if one is doing any practices up around the sixth chakra, which would be entheogens or contemplation. Okay, good. So, there, that's some context. I think we created context. We're going to spend the whole day just creating context. So, we have a principle in Chinese medicine, which is before we tonify, we move stagnation. Right? General principle. Right? So, if a person is wind, cold, damp, I don't want to be giving them ginseng and astragalus right then. Maybe tomorrow, maybe in 2 hours, but depending on signs and symptoms, but not right now. There's something else to do. We move stagnation. Stagnation is just code for what's not real. And tonification is code for strengthening what's real. Whether it's yin, yang, jing, shen, whatever it is we're tonifying. Blood, that's all real. And what isn't real are the 7 internal and external pathogens: wind, cold, damp, heat, dryness, fear, desire, anxiety. That's all not real. Okay. So the most significant stagnation is ignorance. If we were to express the creative impulse as the evolutionary impulse, the life force, I can, I will, I must. Jing, qi, shen, heaven, human, earth, moon, star, sun. I can, I will, I must. And there are 3 spiritual questions. Who am I? Why am I here? How shall I live? Who am I? Why am I here? How shall I live? Everyone who comes to us, most people who come to us are focused on the 3rd question. How shall I live? Should I marry this guy? Should I divorce this guy? Should I play bassoon or should I play trumpet? Should I live in Ashland or should I move to Medford? Should I move to France? Should I do the ABORM training or should I do the course in this? That's how shall I live. That's how shall I live. Should I have another kid? Should I buy another dog? That's all, how shall I live? The thing is, one has to answer, one cannot answer that question without knowing who one actually is. Who am I is the motive cause of universal evolution. The entire course of cosmic evolution can be understood from the perspective of consciousness as being the universe asking the question, who am I? And human beings seem to be the form of matter after 15 billion years, at least in this part of the universe, that seems to be actually some demographic of humanity is actually awake to the question of who am I? So when an individual becomes a seeker and an individual is looking for answers, they have already woken up to the motive cause of cosmic evolution. And the category error everybody makes is they look for it outside of themselves. And awakening is, oh my God, I am that. When a person awakens, they discover that what was seeking is what was being sought for. What was seeking is actually the answer. Right? So the first thing we need to do is help people wake up to who am I. Now, in terms of shock, there is no larger stagnation than not knowing who one is. Because if you don't know who you are, then you don't know why you're here, which means the only way you can decide how to live is on genetically programmed and culturally reinforced values. And I have noticed in my many and varied discussions with people over the years, which sometimes reach a certain level of intensity, that most people have no idea. That they actually have no idea. And I have noticed that people will defend to the death values that they're not aware they hold, or they will speak about values and defend them to the death that they've actually never examined. Where did this value come from? Why do I believe in it? And does it actually, according to my own life experience, hold any water at all? And they've never looked at that, and yet they will defend it to the point of getting thrown off of acupuncturists on Facebook. and to the point of wearing suicide vests. And to the point of pushing buttons that do terrible, terrible things. So the first thing we need to do is bring people out of shock, and it is my experience that we're going to be taking a break, just so you know, in 12 minutes. So it is my experience that people will just create a lot of karma based on their own ignorance, and that about 99% of people are ignorant of who they are and why they're here. Most people, almost everybody, is identified with the biographical self that was born in time and will die in time, in denial of all the other dimensions of their own self. Madam in back?
Angela.
What?
My name's Angela.
Angela, yes.
Are you? Who are you being? Who are you now? Then, when you have had something happen, shock, trauma, mm-hmm. And I like to ask, how do you know who you are?
Mm-hmm.
What are those identifying things in the world that are letting you know who you are,
mm-hmm.
or if they are using the outside to decide who they are, which is something we can't control or do anything about. Yeah, what is it? How are you deciding inside? Like, what is that?
Okay.
How are you communicating?
That's you can ask that as a way of bringing it into a person's awareness. Mm-hmm. But the answer to that is given in everything they're doing in every moment anyway. So you don't even have to ask, because it's all right there. But asking can help bring that, make that unconscious process conscious. So that's good. I mean, in a way, you know, I teach a course on diagnosis, a lecture on how to do diagnosis. And all diagnosis is asking a person, who are you? And the answer that almost everybody gives us is, I'm a consequence of my past.
Or they use what they're doing.
What?
Or they use what they're doing.
What do you mean?
They will say, if you say, who are you, they say what they do.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'm a plumber, I'm a this, I'm a that. There's some. So the point is that all of that is identification with a biographical self born in time, that will die in time. That self is real, and it's true, but it's partial. Now, many of the traditions completely deny that dimension of the self to the great detriment of humanity. They say that the personal self, they make the ego congruent with the personal self and with life experience. And they say this is not real, this is not true. And then they have practices to deny all that. And I think from an integral 21st century perspective, we have to say no, that is absolutely real. And it's maybe your interpretations regarding it aren't true. But we don't deny that dimension of the self. But it is a relatively smaller dimension of the self than other aspects of the self which are denied. So we need to embrace all these dimensions of our own self for the sake of engendering awareness of them within others. Most people hold their wound and their trauma. They're so identified with it that to overcome it in a meaningful way, in a way that they can be free in the face of it, would be for who they think they are right now to die. They would have to die. And being deadly serious about it means that self would have to die, and then they'd project that on the person saying deadly serious as being a homicidal maniac. What? No, just a nice person who's homicidal. You meant homicidal in the nicest possible. Okay, so, right. So, the whole first chapter of my red book is on the physiology of shock in Chinese medicine, understanding the physiology of shock. And I make the case in that entire book is about how to get people out of shock, how to take people out of shock, which is a metaphor for waking up. It's a metaphor. Now, Stanislav Grof would say, well, shock is birth trauma. And from a... and I wouldn't deny that, but again, it's a true but partial view. So I just think at this point in history, it seems that humanity recapitulates the ontogeny of the universe. And just as the one consciousness in this universe had to involve itself in matter, and then spend 15 billion years driving matter to increase states of integration and integrity until a form of matter arose that could have this conversation. I've talked about it all this with my dog, and it hasn't gone really anywhere beyond him wagging his tail and dropping the ball at my feet. So humanity, we seem to have we might make the case that the human nervous system is the most highly evolved form of matter thus discovered in the universe. And this is not to deny that dolphins may have way more going than us. They aren't causing the world's problems, but as far as I can tell, they aren't solving them. I saw a dolphin carrying a Trump sign.
No way.
It was a video. It was, did you see the one of the black woman who's voting for Trump? It was right under that. It was a dolphin voting for Trump. So they can't be that evolved. Okay.
Maybe they were on there without their permission.
Yeah, the dolphin had it taken down. So anyway, so I have no opinion. Maybe ants are more evolved than us. Maybe it is white mice running the show. I actually have no idea, but the in what I teach, we're at least responsible for taking responsibility for what we've woken up to. Mm-hmm. Right? And what I've woken up to, which is obvious to me, I would assume to everyone in this room, is we're creating the problems, and there's no problem one can only create a problem to the exact degree to which one is capable of having the solution for it. It's just the yin and yang of it. So I am an idealist, but not strictly an idealist. I'm eminently practical. And I wouldn't say I'm optimistic, but I am cautiously optimistic that we still are able to go forward with this project in this part of the universe with human beings as the vehicle at this point in history. And that hopefully things haven't gotten too far. Now, are you aware that in general the government, a large section of the government and academia are trying to institute policies to get us back to how things were? Like if the government could get us back to 7% GDP a year growth, mm-hmm, with 3% unemployment, it would all be good. And some of us might be aware that we're living in a one-world system now that need new forms of healthcare, politics, military, educational, legal systems. Like we've literally outgrown all the systems that were created, that were really created hundreds of years ago. Right? Hundreds of years ago. And that it's not just a question of changing interest rates or changing this law a little. We've actually outgrown the whole system. Now, who are the people who exist on the planet with such an evolved view of systems theory and understanding of wholeness and holistic concepts that they would be capable of devising these new political, social, economic, and integral systems that we need? Who are those people? Yeah, the practitioners of Chinese medicine. we are actually the human beings on the planet with the most sophisticated embrace of systems theory that exists. And the problem is that most of us are stuck in the 70s. Back in the 70s. Do you see? And haven't implicated ourselves deeply enough. We're still struggling with, like, where's liver 14, and is eight principle better than five elements? And, well, who the hell cares about any of that? Just to sum up, because I have 2 minutes before the break. So I practiced for 30 years full time. I've done just tipping over 80,000 clinical sessions. And if you ask me what heals, just I have to honestly say, I don't know. I don't know what heals. But I'm pretty sure that the foundation of healing is my own integrity. And then the question is, integrity to what? Donald Trump has integrity. The question is, well, he does. What's he having integrity to?
Himself.
Well, he's having integrity to what a two-year-old has integrity to, which is, I'm going to say and do anything that crosses my radar screen with no filtering. I have to suck and touch and prod and bite and put in my mouth and feel everything. Everything. And he's an unrepressed two-year-old. Yeah. And Hitler had perfect integrity. Hitler had a spiritual experience in a trench in World War I after being gassed, and he saw that it was his destiny to purge Europe of Jews. And he lived with perfect integrity to that vision. He gave it everything. He gave it everything, right? He got the idea he was deadly serious, right? Deadly serious. So when we talk about integrity, we always have to say integrity to what? And in this, in the what I'm teaching, in the teaching that I'm giving, it's integrity to the integral recognition of no separation. It's integrity to evolution, which is the recognition of a context without end. And it's integrity to spirit, which is the recognition that my mind and my body are a vehicle for the transmission of a force that is always seeking to transcend itself and is always transcending itself deeper into origin and further ahead toward the true, the good, the beautiful. And that as practitioners, it's up to us to be the living representation of that. We have more spiritual experience than Jesus had. I mean, Jesus just had one fundamental insight. He didn't get mud packs at Eslan and then go do a vision quest and then go do the forum and then do a CanCar and then to read After Enlightenment the Laundry. Jesus would have thought, I'm not doing any freaking laundry. Jewish men didn't do the laundry. Jewish men still don't do the laundry. Anyway, so we're on break for 15 minutes, okay? And by the way, I'm taping this, and you will all get links to the audio, but it's just for you guys, okay? Yay.